You're listening to The Takeaway Podcast. Look for us on Twitter and Facebook by searching for The Takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry, looking at the calendar and noting 28 days in February, and this is the last day of our shortest month. 27 amendments to the U.S. Constitution. Well, as if they needed much of an excuse, the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia has been reviewing all 27 amendments each day this month. And to make things nice and neat here on the 28th day of the month, they have taken up the challenge of looking ahead to what might be or even should be up for amending next. Later this hour, a tour through the amendments and a look at some of the proposals they see out there, as well as some we've solicited from you.
This is Rick from Los Angeles. My constitutional amendment would be to make all election days a federal holiday, thereby making it illegal for anyone to not be able to vote any time during the hours that polls are open.
That would make us a bit like Australia, Rick. Thanks for that. Or from Richmond, Virginia, modify state congressional districts to eliminate gerrymandering. And that would certainly eliminate something unique to our American style of democracy. Only 27 amendments in well over two centuries, but it's not for lack of trying. The bar is high. Two-thirds of both houses of Congress and majority votes in three-quarters of the states. That's what it takes to ratify an amendment. Nevertheless, 11,500 amendments have started that long journey that begins with being introduced in Congress. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE to introduce a 28th amendment of your own. We'll be revealing some of our favorite suggestions with the National Constitution Center a little later this hour. But we begin here with a reminder that however much we talk about it, there is no explicit right to privacy in the U.S. Constitution. It's a reminder that has quite literally struck a nerve. The latest revelations from the Edward Snowden archive show a program called Optic Nerve, operating through the NSA and the British surveillance agency GCHQ, have been collecting and storing the webcam images of millions of Yahoo users worldwide. Yahoo claims that this is an outrage to their own corporate privacy. They have denied any prior knowledge of Optic Nerve and described it as being completely unacceptable. Typically, but perhaps not so helpfully, GCHQ said in a statement that what the agency did was not unlawful. Joining us now is Spencer Ackerman, U.S. National Security Editor at The Guardian and the reporter who broke the story. Welcome, Spencer.
Thanks for having me.
What's unique about this webcam surveillance, technologically speaking and in legal terms? Is this just a British matter that GCHQ is responding to, or is the NSA really involved here too?
Well, one of the amazing things that we found while reporting this story is that GCHQ distinguishes not at all on the front end of its collection from making sure that it doesn't pick up data, Yahoo webcam imagery from Americans and from Britons. And on the search end, it distinguishes between two categories of what it can search for: people suspected of being in the UK and those who are not suspected of being in the UK. So it's very likely, it's certainly possible, and nothing stops Americans' data when they use Yahoo webcams from coming into GCHQ's enormous troves. And then these troves work with NSA tools like the X-Keyscore query tool that we earlier reported and broke to you, as well as some other NSA tools. GCHQ is NSA's most important partner around the world. The NSA wouldn't answer us directly when we asked what level of access they had to Optic Nerve. So this is really an open question about the vulnerability of Americans' webcam information.
Technologically speaking, are webcam streams just as findable and downloadable and piratable as, text files?
They are. What's amazing is that Yahoo only recently began encrypting its data as it transited across the internet, which means that it was sort of sitting out, easily interceptable by GCHQ and other intelligence agencies.
So, what kinds of images do we know have been downloaded? What's their character? And aside from the criteria that you already mentioned, is there any sense that this is anything other than just a wide net sweep of images?
Well, one thing we found is that inside this trove of webcam imagery is, as one who spent more than 5 minutes on the internet could easily anticipate, a tremendous amount of pornography. The documents internally discuss efforts by GCHQ to make sure that analysts' delicate sensibilities are preserved when they're looking through this trove. So they try and not see pornography that they've intercepted, but they concede in the documents that that turns out to be rather difficult.
Does that indicate that perhaps they're not really screening much at all? That they're not targeting individuals who are actually involved in criminal investigations at all? If they're
throwing
the net so wide, yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The documents explicitly talk about unselected imagery that gets collected on the front end. The theory is that, as they write in the documents, some intelligence targets are known to use Yahoo webcams. So on that theory, if you get all the stuff, then inside that enormous trove, you'll find potentially information on people that are intelligence targets, but you'll find a lot more information on people who aren't suspected of wrongdoing at all.
Spencer, finally, from what you can tell, is this a vulnerability in the way Yahoo connects to webcams, or is this a vulnerability that would be system-wide, that basically is part of any webcam arrangement with your computer?
As we've been reporting since we broke the story of bulk domestic phone data collection in June, information that transits the web unencrypted is vulnerable. That's not an exculpation of intelligence agencies who are taking this stuff, but nevertheless, without encryption, data is very vulnerable as it transits through the internet in ways that your average user probably doesn't anticipate.
And there could be somebody watching you live right now, Spencer, eh?
Well, you did ask me to connect for this conversation over the internet, so I guess. But I hope the people who are listening to this conversation are your dedicated listeners.
Well, they certainly are. Spencer Ackerman, U.S. National Security Editor at The Guardian. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So two things have popped up from obscurity in the past 24 hours regarding the turmoil in Ukraine. One in the very recognizable face of former President Viktor Yanukovych, who spoke from the Russian city of Rostov, speaking in Russian, saying, "I am still Ukraine's president." He called the opposition terrorists, but he said nothing about the other development that has popped up, the unmarked troops showing up unannounced to stand guard at two Crimean airports. They are being called terrorists with automatic weapons by the acting president of Ukraine, Ukrainian parliament speaker Alexander Turchinov. Joining us once again to try and make sense of more disturbing developments in Ukraine is John Herbst, former ambassador to Ukraine from 2003 to 2006. Ambassador, welcome.
Thank you.
So if a unmarked army showed up at an airport, in your experience, how terrified would you be? And if you were in Ukraine, who would you suspect those folks actually were?
Well, you have a senior Ukrainian official claiming that these are Russian troops. And I imagine he must have some evidence for that. But the point is, we just don't know.
How militarized is this zone? I mean, we learned yesterday on this program that Sevastopol is the home of two navies simultaneously, Ukraine and Russia, which I suppose the rest of the world knows, but I didn't know till yesterday. Are there lots of security, armies, uniformed personnel cruising around Crimea? And is the appearance of these forces completely outrageous?
I've visited Sevastopol. I visited Crimea when I was ambassador in Kyiv. It's not a particularly militarized area. Yes, as you've mentioned, there are two bases there. But you did not see, normally, even in Sevastopol, armed troops. You might see men in uniform, but not armed troops. And, of course, the fact that we don't know that they are, in fact, Russian troops means that there is flexibility for Russia to back off if, in fact, they are involved in this. And this is something which is best handled by diplomacy.
Exactly. And I guess what would diplomats be doing at this point, trying to identify whose troops these are or trying to get some sort of agreement with parties whose identity we do know to just back away and come to some agreement?
Well, President Obama spoke to President Putin, and Putin assured him that he's not going to intervene in Ukraine. Now, that could simply be a lie. The man's not known for telling the truth. Now, there's evidence put out by the Kyiv Post, which is obviously a paper in Ukraine, in Kyiv, with documents found by a member of the Ukrainian Rada, their parliament, Mr. Moskal, which show that a former senior Russian intelligence official was guiding the use of sniper fire and live fire by the Berkut, the Ukrainian police, when they were indiscriminately killing their own citizens. So that's a disturbing piece of evidence of Russian involvement in the massacre in the Maidan.
I guess the question that's really sort of concerning to diplomats and for the entire world is if some pro-Russian group in Crimea should step forward and say, these are our heroes, then all of a sudden we may have a Crimean war in the 21st century. And the question is, will then Russia be able to back away?
That's an interesting question. This is a tense situation, and we need to be careful. Everyone involved needs to be careful. There's no question that there are pro-Russian elements in Crimea. In fact, the majority of the people there are ethnic Russians, but there are some who are interested in creating trouble. It's also true that there's a large minority of Tatars who want to remain part of Ukraine. And when there were demonstrations and counter-demonstrations at Sevastopol, which led to casualties a day or two ago, the Tatars were prominent among those demonstrating on behalf of the Ukrainian government.
If these are Russian troops, by being unidentified and sort of nominally unknown at this point, has Vladimir Putin possibly handed a playing card to Yanukovych, who can somehow maybe even wink and nod and suggest that he's got military backing?
Well, I would not rule that out, but that would be a fool's game. Already his reputation is severely tarnished. He's involved in ordering those massacres in the Maidan. So he is finished as a politician in Ukraine.
All right.
I think it's foolish for the Russians to be involved with a man as odious as Mr. Yanukovych at this point.
Former Ambassador Herbst, thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
John Herbst was ambassador to Ukraine from 2003 to 2006. But they are facing some serious constitutional fixes there in the Ukraine. I love this constitutional fix one of you came up with. It goes directly with the conversation earlier in the hour with Spencer Ackerman about NSA and British webcam surveillance. The guaranteed right to privacy, says one of you in Miami, Florida, should be the next amendment to the Constitution. This amendment should also encompass the private sector because companies such as Google, Facebook, and Amazon already collect and hold far more information than I think most Americans are comfortable with. We're asking you to come up with a 28th amendment to the Constitution, a next amendment. And here's another proposal straight off recent headlines.
Any child born in the United States would only be a citizen if both their parents were citizens or legal aliens. This would do away with the problem of many children who are legal citizens, but their parents are not.
Thanks for that. That listener was from Wilmington, Delaware. Can we make it an even 28 constitutional amendments? What's your suggestion? 877-8-MY-TAKE or go to facebook.com/The Takeaway. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com. With tools to help businesses and professionals monitor and manage online reviews. Now offering a review kiosk to help customers create reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com.
We're going to listen to some voices now, speaking of the extraordinary difficult for some people to make it in America, a problem that's very familiar. But there's only one of these voices, I'm guessing, that you're going to recognize.
I could have possibly been a high school dropout. By sophomore year, I wasn't doing so well.
I didn't have a dad in the house. And I was angry about it, even though I didn't necessarily realize it at the time. I made bad choices.
My mom thought I'd be another young black male on the street.
I got high without always thinking about the harm that it could do. I didn't always take school as seriously as I should have.
I would wake up, shower, get dressed, and then go back to sleep.
The fact that too many of them are falling by the wayside, dropping out, unemployed, involved in negative behavior, going to jail, being profiled. This is a moral issue for our country.
From President Barack Obama speaking yesterday about himself to radio rookie reporter Michael Brown, you heard there on WNYC in New York, speaking of his challenges growing up in Harlem. Two African-American men in America. One became president. Young Michael Brown got through school eventually, ended up winning an award, and seems to be on his way to making some contribution. The president raised this issue yesterday by announcing a program aimed at cultivating the kind of mentoring that he believes helped him and will help other African-American males and young men of color to break a cycle of underachievement or worse. The program would mobilize $350 million, mostly from private charities, over the next 5 years to find and replicate best practices for improving the odds of success for young men of color. Join us now to talk about this is Lester Spence, professor of political science and Africana studies at Johns Hopkins University. He's the author of Stare in the Darkness, The Limits of Hip Hop and Black Politics. Lester, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
What was your reaction to this, brothers taking care of each other kind of program that sounds very, very feel good, but certainly has a lot of passion behind it from President Barack Obama?
I was passionately upset. I was passionately upset. And I have to say at the outset, I have friends who actually attended that event. One of my good friends, Tanya Allen, she's the CEO of the Skillman Foundation in Detroit. And there are a number of foundations like Skillman who are doing incredible work to help improve the odds and the life chances of young black boys and young black girls. But the problem is that the president here is he's acting more like a parent or an uncle than he's acting like the president, right? I mean, he's treating these kids as if their primary problem is kind of a cultural issue that perhaps private philanthropy can help deal with, rather than a structural issue that actually requires government intervention.
All right. Well, there's two things there. Let's take them one at a time. First of all, yeah. the question of mentoring. Now, our young man, Michael Brown, who you just heard in the introduction there, talked in his story for Radio Rookies about how important a particular teacher was, Mr. Pita, who was part of the Urban Assembly Academy for History and Citizenship High School for Men that he went to. Listen to this.
I don't even know how he got me to think about my future. He just talked about how a lot of things in life couldn't be achieved without an education. And I would make life harder for myself if I didn't graduate and continue through college.
Now, is it wrong for Michael, for us, and for the president to focus on this mentoring as an effective agent of change?
Well, here's the thing. Let's say we were, instead of talking about young black men, we were talking about NASA, right? And what we wanted to do is kind of, we wanted to create a new initiative to help put men on Mars. We wouldn't suggest having bake sales to raise money for NASA, right? I mean, if somebody actually articulated that, if a president articulate that as a policy, we would think that he was on something. Mentorship is fine, right? Most of the people in my life are mentors in one way or another, and I wouldn't be where I am today if I didn't have mentors, you know, my dad and other folk.
Sure.
But what we're talking about is what is the role of government? He's the president of the United States. He's not, I mean, he's Sasha and Malia's dad, but he's not these kids' parent.
All right. So finally, yeah. I mean, that raises this second point. I mean, maybe he's just frustrated that he doesn't have the power to make those structural changes with the Congress as it is right now. So he's going to do what he can do. And this is it.
Well, I'm a political scientist, right? So I know that the president's constrained. I get that. But the thing is as soon as he comes out the gate saying what we're talking about is not another big government program, as soon as he comes out the gate saying that, right, he makes it difficult for people to actually fight for more progressive resources from the government. People now, because he said this is not a big government program, people interested in getting the government to spend more money now have to go up against the president, right? So it's like he takes with one hand, he gives with one hand, and then takes away on the other. It's a beautiful thing to see the president standing with young black boys. I'm a father of three powerful black boys, and that image is a powerful one. But that is not a substitute for governance. It's not, and we shouldn't accept that.
Lester Spence, professor of political science and Africana studies at Johns Hopkins University, reacting to the president's initiative yesterday. He's the author of Stare in the Darkness, The Limits of Hip Hop and Black Politics. Lester, thanks.
Oh, thank you.
So if you can't actually change the eating habits of Americans with an executive order, maybe the next best thing is to change the labels.
The new label will allow you to immediately spot the calorie count because it will be in large font and not buried in the fine print.
New fonts, no more fine print. First Lady Michelle Obama announcing a federal overhaul of food labeling. It will require manufacturers, among other things, to list more realistic serving sizes and add details about added sugars. Helpful? Well, it certainly gives the appearance of doing something for consumers, but will they respond to this sort of thing in making healthy eating choices? Julie Downs, Carnegie Mellon professor, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Do consumers respond to this sort of thing? Are labels an important indicator of how consumers are going to use food items?
Well, I think it's important to think about different kinds of consumers. There are certainly some consumers who are pretty calorie conscious, who do pay attention to how many calories are in things, try to watch what they eat. And I think for those consumers, this is going to be make it a lot easier for them to track how many calories are in things and make better choices and be happier about their choices and generally be beneficial.
Do you think the mission here is to get people to pay more attention to the calories, or is the calorie count really the most important piece of information on the label? And so it should be the first thing you see.
Well, I think it's, you know, it's nice to think that people are going to read this label in depth, and some people certainly will. But if we want to get just one piece of information across to people, which is a lot to hope for many, many people, the calorie count probably is the main thing we want people to pay attention to.
So this is an actual good idea.
Well, I think it's a good idea for a lot of reasons. I think it's not going to be a panacea. It's not going to solve all our problems. But I think people can use it. People who want to use it will be able to use it better. But I think there's a lot of people who aren't going to use it.
In the research that you do, I mean, this is kind of a design question. I mean, the label sort of sits in a place. If you don't want to look at that information, you know where not to look. If you're really interested in the information, you can certainly find it. But maybe the better approach would be to force manufacturers that if something is over a certain amount of calories, it has to be the color green. You know, if it's under a certain set of calories, it has to be the color yellow. So you immediately spot, you almost can't escape the calorie count issue.
Yeah, we actually have some research coming out looking at that kind of what we call heuristic labeling, where we try to make the information simpler for people to use. And that does seem to help, possibly better than numbers. Numbers are intimidating for a lot of people. So making the information just as easy to use as humanly possible seems to make it a little bit better for people to be able to actually use it.
And if you get to the end of the sort of checkout line and your shopping cart is entirely filled with sort of the color of high calories, whereas everyone next to you is low calorie colors, it makes a stronger point than an individual label.
Yeah, I mean, that would take some sort of technological advance to kind of get all of that, you know, into one place and really have that make sense. When buying packaged foods, you know, you can imagine calorie counts on an individual serving of potato chips or something like that is pretty meaningful. But when you're sort of buying things in bulk items, and it's going to be a little harder to use that information.
Do you think that labels, generally speaking, have been a good experiment in American consumers knowing more about what it is they're buying?
I think it's been, you know, since the package labeling was introduced in the 90s, there's a fair amount of research on how people use that, suggesting that people aren't really using that day to day to make individual decisions. But manufacturers are pretty conscious of what they have to put on their packaging, what they have to put on their food that they produce. And so some products get reformulated to be a little more attractive. And so there you see some benefits that maybe aren't directly from the consumer using the label, but from the manufacturer not wanting to slap, you know, 500 calories on this soda straight on their label.
Punching up the calorie count on labeling is certainly the White House's mission at this point. Julie Downs, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Julie Downs studies decision making. She's a professor at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh.
Dad, are any of these movies good?
Worst episode ever.
I see a lot of films. I love all of them.
Your job is to rate movies on a scale from good to excellent.
Hated it.
Big Movie Friday with Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday and co-host of the Movie Date podcast with Kristen Meinzer, a culture producer for The Takeaway. Welcome, guys.
Hi, John.
Hey, John.
And close listeners to the podcast know your Oscar predictions already, so we're going to present them here on the radio program as well, 2 days away from Oscar night. And is there a theme that either of you have gathered from this year's crop of movies, Kristen?
Well, I think that the big thing is that about two-thirds of the nominees for Best Picture are all based on real stories. And I think something else that really jumps out at me this year is the roles for women were just horrible. And that means that the nominations are a little bit strange for the female categories.
Raper, how about you?
Yeah, I would say the same thing about the fact-based dramas, which is kind of interesting. But I think actually what's going to be the big winner on Oscar night is going to be Gravity, which is the escapist sci-fi thriller.
And American Hustle and Gravity are leading in nominations. They have 10 each. 12 Years a Slave is right behind with 9 nominations. Let's start with the performers, though. Can we, you've just said terrible things about the actress roles. Is anybody going to be happy walking away with the statue, Kristen?
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody is leaning toward Cate Blanchett winning. She's been cleaning up in all of the other awards shows for Blue Jasmine.
I was forced to take a job selling shoes on Madison Avenue. Oh, so humiliating. Friends, I'd had at dinner parties, our apartment came in and I waited on them. I mean, do you have any idea what that's like?
People love her in this role. I personally didn't love the role, but there just wasn't a lot of other stuff out there this year.
She's up against Judi Dench,
and then also Meryl Streep for August Osage County. She's, the roles that she's up against, a lot of people haven't even seen those movies.
Rafer, do you agree with Cate Blanchett as the lead here?
It's kind of a gimme at this point. What I think is going to be interesting is how she parses her acceptance speech to either address or ignore the Woody Allen scandal. So that could be interesting.
For both of you, supporting, is Jennifer Lawrence going to have like 2 years in a row here?
I wouldn't be surprised if Jennifer Lawrence got it, but boy, would I just love it if Lupita Nyong'o from 12 Years a Slave got it. She's gotten a couple of the smaller awards, but Jennifer Lawrence is such a crowd favorite.
And Rafer?
I also think Lupita Nyong'o should get the award, but people loved Jennifer Lawrence as this wacky Long Island housewife. They loved that role. They loved her rendition of Live and Let Die in the movie. I think she's going to get it again.
All right. So a lot of agreement on the actresses. Agreement on the actors. Rafer, what do you think?
I think it's going to be Matthew McConaughey for Dallas Buyers Club.
You enjoy your life, don't you? You only got one. Hey. Thanks for coming.
Wildflowers.
It's such an incredible performance. I mean, already everyone knows he lost this massive amount of body weight to play an AIDS victim, but it's also just a terrific, terrific performance. I didn't think he had a chance until he won at the Golden Globes, and then I think the momentum for him really built. So I think it's a no-brainer.
No-brainer, Kristen?
Total no-brainer. I think he was just fantastic in that role. He's just the heart and soul of the movie. And also for supporting actor, I think it's also going to go to Dallas Buyers. I think Jared Leto is going to get that.
So they'll at least get 2 out of 10. Would you go along with that, Rafer?
Yeah, I would for sure. Leto's also a shoe-in for supporting actor, although I would love to see Jonah Hill get the Oscar for Wolf of Wall Street. I thought he was great, but Leto's going to get that.
An amazing performance. So on the Best Picture, is this really a question of escapism versus serious filmmaking, Rafer?
I think it is. I think I was really surprised at how the critics really rallied around Gravity. They loved it. They loved the directing. They loved the technological razzle-dazzle of it, even though I felt it was kind of a slim, not that interesting space thriller. But they loved it, and I think the Oscars are going to love it too. Whether or not it gets Best Picture, I don't know. I still think that could go to 12 Years a Slave.
Now you tell me all is lost. Tell no one who I am. That's the way to survive. Well, I don't want to survive. I want to live.
Kristen?
I wouldn't be surprised if it gets split this year, if Cuarón gets it for director, if Best Picture goes to 12 Years, or who knows, there's a slight chance that American Hustle could still end up getting Best Picture. But if I was going to place my bets, I would say Best Picture would go to 12 Years still.
All right. Kristen and Rafer, have a great weekend.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, John.
There's a lot of momentum this Oscar season, it turns out, associated with the Oscar-nominated songs as well. While they are an interesting crop of pop tunery and indie intensity, and there's a bit of a scandal, there is one solid favorite. John Schaefer, host of Soundcheck on our partner station WNYC, actually follows these Academy Awards for songs closely as something of a gauge of where pop music is right now. John, welcome back.
Good to see you, John.
So a fan walks into a musician's office, right? Sees an Oscar on the shelf. Goes, wow, you won an Oscar. Musician walks into a musician's office, sees there's an Oscar on the shelf, and goes, so you didn't win a Grammy. Is that basically how we are to interpret the Oscar song category? What's it all about?
Well, you know, it is within the music industry, I would say a Grammy occupies pride of place.
Higher on the shelf.
But, you know, there is nothing wrong with having a little Oscar up there on the mantelpiece as well. And certainly the four eligible nominees for Best Song are really going to be hoping that they walk off with a statue.
Because what does it do for sales? What is the impact?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question because at least one of the songs that has been nominated is a bona fide hit and is not going to really get much of a boost sales-wise because there's nowhere else to go.
Right.
I'm talking about Pharrell's song Happy. For the others, you know, it's just... it's a kind of affirmation of the importance of music outside of the traditional Hollywood scoring for a songwriter who is, in all probability, a newcomer to the Academy.
All right, well, let's begin with the one that you just mentioned, Pharrell Williams from Despicable Me 2, the song Happy. Because I'm happy. Clap along if you feel like a room without a roof.
My kids know this song.
Everybody knows
this
song. This song is not just a bona fide hit. It's kind of a cultural moment. The video, the 24-hour Happy video that Pharrell Williams put together is getting millions of YouTube views, and the official 4-minute video is like up to almost 80 million views. So, you know, this thing is a juggernaut.
Another movie which has a certain amount of cultural significance. I mean, how are we to evaluate falling in love with your own operating system, right? The movie Her, the moon song here performed by Karen O. I'm lying
on the moon. My dear, I'll be there. This is a great moment for kind of hipster culture. You know, you have Karen O, lead singer of the indie rock band Yeah Yeah Yeahs, and it was co-written with Spike Jonze, the director. So it's a lovely moment, and I think in this case, the nomination will be the prize.
You two performed and wrote the song for Mandela, Long Walk to Freedom, a blockbuster bit of history. The movie didn't do so well at the Oscars, but the song's up for a nomination. We can't fall any further. The big rock acts have a good record at the Oscars.
You know, there's always the chance that the Academy will vote for the name they recognize. And U2, having been around since 1979, a certain amount of cachet. You know,
work for Elton John.
Yeah, it certainly has. I mean, you know, the Golden Globes, they loved this song, but this is not the Golden Globes.
Well, the Oscars don't give award for U2-ness. It's for something else. It seems to me that this song is the major competition for Happy and Despicable Me 2. It's from the Disney movie Frozen. Don't let them know. Well, now they know. Let it go. Let it go. Can't hold it back anymore. Let it go. Let it go. Turn away and slam the door. Very pop, very Titanic, very...
And it's got the Disney imprimatur. I mean, Idina Menzel, huge hit on Broadway, Wicked, and coming back in the spring in a new musical. She is not the only one to sing this song in the soundtrack. Demi Lovato sings it elsewhere in the film. And there are some, myself included, who think this is by no means the best song in the soundtrack, which has some great stuff.
I agree with you. I actually agree with you.
But if I were a Las Vegas bookmaker, this would be my odds-on favorite for the Oscar.
And no possibility of contention because it was disqualified. Tell us a little bit about the controversy over.
Well, you know, when the initial list of five songs came out, there were the four we've talked about,
yeah,
all of them well-known musical names, maybe not in Hollywood, but certainly in the music world. And then there was this song called Alone Yet Not Alone, apparently from a film of the same name. I'd never heard of the film, and it turned out nobody had heard of the film. And I was wondering, how did this even get nominated? It turns out that the composer, Bruce Broughton, was a former governor of the Academy and in charge of the music division. So there was something that didn't smell quite right there. And the Academy quickly did a little investigating and decided that the composer had done some irregular vote getting, let's say.
But we will play it just for the heck of it.
I'm alone, yet not alone. God's the light that will guide me home.
That's enough of that. I think it's about, it wasn't disqualified, though, for that, right?
It was not disqualified for musical reasons, but rather for procedural ones.
I see, I see. Well, John Schaefer made the best song win, right?
I would like the best song to win. I believe it's going to be Let It Go from Frozen.
Host of Soundcheck on our partner station WNYC, John Schaefer, thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
That's 27 amendments in more than 220 years, the last one added in 1992. Maybe it's time for one more constitutional amendment. Grafton Hale's 28th Amendment, he's from Auburn, Georgia. I would require each law to come with its own supporting tax, with the monies received to go to that law only. No unfunded mandates, he writes. Penny McCray says, an amendment that recognizes the sanctity of all life. If life is to be taken or used to produce food, utmost care and respect must be given in doing so. It might improve the lot of animals taken to slaughter, pigs and hens kept in abominable conditions. Thanks for that, Penny. Number 28, what's it going to be? You tell us. 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's our number. Leave us a comment at thetakeaway.org. Listen, there is a veritable constitutional convention going on right now at thetakeaway.org. The House shall be in order. A convention is actually one way of amending the U.S. Constitution. If two-thirds of the states convene a constitutional convention, just like was held in Philadelphia, that wrote the original U.S. document in the 1780s, then technically everything is on the table. It's in Article 5 of the Constitution, by the way. And it hasn't happened since that first convention, but as I've said, we've convened one along with the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia. Here are some suggestions. Jacksonville Beach, Florida. Free speech is defined as a single human being capable of rational thought, thereby unions, corporations, or any other recognized legal grouping as a group of persons is not entitled to participate in the legal process beyond what is available to the American citizen. One of you from Grubville, Missouri, would word it a little differently. 28th Amendment, corporations are not people, because the corporate welfare in the U.S. undermines the welfare of the citizenry.
Hi, this is Maya Vamrasam from the Delaware River Watershed, and my amendment would be the right to pure water, clean air, and a healthy environment for present and future generations.
Thank you, Maya. Here's one from Anoka, Minnesota. Congressional term limits to put an end to career politicians, or Charlie Washburn from Worcester, Mass. The ERA for women would be a good place to start because all men are created equal, Charlie notes. So many of you proposing a 28th Amendment to the Constitution to go with the other 27, just like the day February 28th goes with the other days of this month. To talk about their month-long look at the U.S. amendments to the Constitution and to discuss theirs and your suggestions for a 28th Amendment, joining us is Curry Sautner, Vice President of Visitor Experience and Education at the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia. Curry, welcome.
Thank you so much for having us here.
So take us through your journey this February.
Well, it's been probably the most festive February we've ever had at the Constitution Center, both on site at the museum in Philadelphia as well as online. We really wanted to make sure that February was celebrated through looking at African American History Month, but also by looking at all the amendments that we've added to the Constitution over the years. And so we started with, hey, what does that one say? Let's do every day. Let's talk about the amendment that is associated with that number, talk about what it says, and then get people's feedback on it. All the time saying, now looking at all of these, what would you add? Would you add a new amendment or would you not add a new amendment? And the responses have been anywhere from really funny and humorous to really smart, intelligent, great discussion starters about what should we change to the Constitution or what do we need to leave alone.
And Curry, just looking at history just for a moment before we look at the 28th suggestions here, take us through what you've explored.
You'd be amazed that even though the Bill of Rights, those first 10 amendments have been around the longest, people are still, they're the hot ones. They're the ones people like to talk about the most. They're the ones when the people think of the Constitution that they really think of those amendments. And that's what was really heated and really, you know, connected and discussing and getting people to have a democratic deliberation. And that's our job as a museum, is to talk about the past, to talk about the present, and to have people talk to each other about it as well. So first 10 days were really hot, lots of conversation, lots of discussion back and forth between our people in the museum as well as online. And then, yeah, there are other days that are more just, oh, by the way, did you know what this one was? And people were doing a lot more of, oh, I didn't realize it. You know, I didn't realize that was in there. I always like to think of the 20th and the 25th as, you know, those amendments that they kind of had to clarify over and over again. They're the secession and exactly who takes over if something happens to the president or vice president.
It's been a romp through, you know, big issues and kind of fine print issues in looking at the 27 amendments. What are the themes that came out of the people who really want to propose a 28th here on the 28th day of February?
So a lot of the stuff that is coming out is things that people have been talking about in the public sphere for probably the last few years, if not longer. So it's definitely top of mind of people. Our top ones so far, and we're doing a program today that is going to ask the visitors in the museum which one out of the top 10 they're going to vote for. But the top one so far is term limits for Congress. The next four are kind of really close in line. They're all about a vote away from each other. So very tight race on what comes in second and third. The second one was general campaign finance reform. The third one was eliminating corporate personhood, which I heard just a minute ago from your people as well, which is interesting. The fourth one was abolishing the Electoral College, which I feel is one that will always come up. And then marriage equality amendment came in very high with us as well, as
really?
Well as the Equal Rights Amendment.
How difficult is it to ratify any of these suggestions, great and small?
Definitely very difficult. I mean, the beauty of the Constitution is that it has the ability to be amended, to be added to or changed. And that's a brilliant thing that our framers put into it. They had gone through the experience of the Articles of Confederation, where you had to have a unanimous vote to change anything, and it never happened because it's too hard and you just can't get everybody to agree. So to have that spelled out, it's a part. Article 5 in the Constitution spells out how it's done, but they didn't want to make it easy. You don't want to change something on a whim. That's not good either. And so it has to go through a long process to amend the Constitution. And you're really changing how our country works and the structure of government when you're doing that. Some amendments within the amendment proposal states how many years the amendment has to be ratified. So if it's in there, that can be kind of the expiration date. If it's not ratified in this many years, then it expires and it has to go through the process again. Now, what makes me laugh is the last amendment that was added, the 27th Amendment, was on the books from the time the Bill of Rights, before the Bill of Rights. It was a part of that initial group of amendments that were sent out to the states to be ratified for the first few amendments to be ratified. And it wasn't ratified. It was actually number one on the list. So when we think of the First Amendment as the most important, it's number one. It really wasn't number one. It was number, I think it was two or three. But the first one was the 27th Amendment.
That's amazing.
And it took the longest, right?
That is crazy.
Took the longest.
I love that.
Let me give you a couple more of our suggestions here. Let me give you a couple more of our suggestions. Yep. Little Rock, Arkansas, federalizing the voting process so elections that affect federal positions are uniform. No more shifting early vote days. Standardized criteria for the election process. That's Little Rock. Gonzales, Florida, it would have to cover the area of artificial intelligence and assure humans would never be at risk of a technological takeover, which is now looming around the corner. I guess we'd call that the Matrix Amendment or something like that. A lot of people gave this a lot of thought. Same in your shop?
Most of them. We also did have an amendment to make every Friday pizza day, which as a pizza lover was very entertaining for me. But it also at least gave our kids in the museum a chance to put one up there and then have people discuss it. So our goal is to get people talking about the process, talking about the Constitution and their views and listening to each other's views. So even though it was a pizza amendment and maybe not the most appropriate, was still a way to get the kids. Well, how would you actually get that pizza proposed and walk through? Sometimes it's easier to talk about the process and not the exact amendment because they don't always know what they want to put through, but they should know how it's done.
Well, it was a great idea for the month of February, and it certainly worked well for Curry Sautner, who's vice president of visitor experience and education at the National Constitution Center. 28 days in February, 27 amendments, and we're talking about the 28th. Curry, thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
Some more of your 28th amendments now, not of the pizza variety. Here's a popular sentiment from Waterboro, South Carolina. I don't know how it would be worded, but it would be a protection of invasion of privacy by new technologies. But Aaron from Kansas City, Kansas objects. Don't touch my constitution, he writes. We don't need a new constitutional amendment to protect privacy because the First Amendment protects the freedom of speech and the press to include what we sign up for and internet posts. The Fourth Amendment protects the right to be secure from unreasonable searches. Join the Constitutional Convention here at The Takeaway by introducing an amendment at 8778-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. Have a great weekend. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.